Good afternoon. I would like to thank organizers. I'm glad to be here. I'm in a difficult position because, as Kenneth Marcus rightly said, before he left, leaving me here as a lawyer alone, the greatest and crucial division is this division between lawyers and non-lawyers, but I'll try to do my best. Calls for a boycott against Israeli goods, scholars, services, etc., carry a significant legal irony. While appealing to the desire to compel Israel to stop violating human rights, boycott campaigners themselves may breach various principles of international human rights law. At the same time, legal actions undertaken by Israel in order to reduce the effects of boycotts, namely the anti-boycott 2011 law, are highly questionable from the point of view of international law. Several international and regional human rights bodies, including the European Court of Human Rights, have tackled similar dilemmas. In such cases, it was established under what circumstances a boycott may amount to discrimination. However, in my view, what is crucial is the question of what legally qualifies as anti-Semitism. And this is not easy, as it requires legal determination of the point in which, to quote Andre Glucksmann, the anti-Israeli anger turns into anti-Jewish anger. I will try to pinpoint to all frequent cases in which the thin red line between criticism and discrimination of Israel and Israelis has been crossed. Free democratic and pluralistic states and societies, such as in Europe and US, where most of us gathered here are privileged to live, allow everyone to follow his or her conscience, common sense, and free will in making one's choices. No one can prevent a person from abstaining from buying Israeli products or from abstaining from using Israeli technology, or even if that person really wants to follow his or her decisions to the extreme, from using medications produced in Israel. When such a boycott, however, is extrapolated into the public sphere, it is no more just a question of a free individual choice, and it becomes an act of discrimination based on nationality, or even, as the case may be, incitement to hatred or violence against the Israelis. For instance, boycotting Israeli products in supermarkets in some countries has been performed in a robbery-like manner by mass commando units blocking the entrances and marking or removing Israeli products with anti-Israeli labels, marking them with anti-Israeli labels. Any international human rights court, when considering a complaint regarding such a situation, would take into account their impact upon Israeli nationals, even if they were not direct witnesses to such illegal actions. Protecting individuals and valuable groups from a hostile, intimidating, and humiliating atmosphere and social attitude has been recognized as an element of human rights protection in the jurisprudence of the human rights courts more than 50 years ago. As another instance belonging to the same category, consider a situation in which a state or an entity under state control, for example, it could be a public university under supervision of the Ministry of Education, sets the binding directives of boycotting Israel scholars or products. While the concept of embargo belongs to the international law, and it means a ban on export or import of goods and services to and from a given state, no democratic state is imposing right now an embargo on Israel. Hence, a state-sanctioned boycott of Israeli goods, services, and persons would amount to a violation of a number of legal rules belonging to the body of international human rights law. What are those rules? At the level of UN-based human rights protection system, there's of course UN Charter, which sets a rule of equality between nations and a prohibition of discrimination based on nationality. There's also International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. As far as the International Covenant is concerned, there is of course a general ban on discrimination, and Article 20, it imposes on state parties to the covenant an obligation to prohibit by law any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. In turn, the Racial Convention contains a number of provisions which oblige state parties to the convention to, among others, engage in no act or practice of racial discrimination against persons, groups of persons, or institutions, and to ensure that all public authorities and public institutions, national and local, shall act in conformity with this obligation, to take effective measures to review governmental, national, and local policies, and to amend or nullify any laws or regulations which have the effect of creating or perpetuating racial discrimination, and to refrain from sponsoring, defending, or supporting racial discrimination by any person or organization. What is crucial here is that the convention uses the term racial discrimination also to any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preference based on race, color, or national or ethnic origin. A similar strict anti-discrimination principle is contained in the European Convention on Human Rights and its additional protocols. Article 14 of the Convention stipulates that the enjoyment of the rights and freedoms set forth in the Convention shall be secured without discrimination on any ground, such as, among others, race, color, language, national or social origin, or association with a national minority. In addition, the European Convention prohibits any actions which may destroy the axiological basis of the Convention, and thus it prohibits incitement to hatred or violence against any person or group as identified by their national origins. Also, the European Union law is pertinent in this regard. A number of anti-discrimination directives have proclaimed prohibitions of ethnic and nationality-based discrimination, and the ban applies not only to victims of discrimination who are citizens of EU member states. But the most important confirmation of the proposition that calls for boycott of Israeli products or citizens constitute violation of human rights law can be found in the European Court of Human Rights jurisprudence, namely in the judgment in case Willem versus France. In 2002, Mr. Jean-Claude Willem, at the time a mayor of the municipality of Seslin, during a session of the town council and in the presence of journalists, announced that he intended to call to boycott Israeli products in his municipality. He stated that he had taken this decision to protest against what he called anti-Palestinian policies of the Israeli government. The public prosecutor charged him with inciting discrimination on national, racial, and religious grounds. And the Lille Criminal Court sentenced Mr. Willem on appeal and fined him 1,000 euros. His cassation appeal was unsuccessful. In his complaint lodged to the European Court of Human Rights, Mr. Willem claimed that his call to boycott Israeli products was part of a political debate concerning the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and was without doubt a matter of general and public interest. He complained that his conviction had thus constituted a violation of his freedom of speech under Article 10 of the Convention. However, the European Court took the view that Mr. Willem had not been convicted for his political speech, but for inciting to the commission of a discriminatory and therefore punishable act. The court further noted that under French law, the applicant was not entitled to take on the role of government authorities by declaring an embargo on products from a foreign country. And as a result, the court stated that there was no violation of the freedom of speech of Mr. Willem. With just one dissenting opinion of Judge Jungwirth, this ruling is a strong voice in the boycott debate, stating clearly that this type of incitement to discrimination will not be protected by the European Convention on Human Rights. No doubt, if a call for boycott was addressed against a particular person, the court's judgment would be even harsher. The court would have doubtlessly referred to its earlier case law in which it was established that contributing to an atmosphere of intimidation and exclusion of a particular national or ethnic group constitutes a blatant violation of rights and freedoms of members of these groups, and that each state of the Council of Europe has an absolute obligation to counteract such actions, including by legal means. It is also useful to refer to several judgments of other international tribunals. In one of its landmark judgments, the Court of Justice of the European Union ruled that publicly expressed statement by an employer claiming that he will not employ individuals coming from Morocco constitutes an act of direct discrimination and is forbidden by the EU law. Furthermore, the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, reviewing the case of Zihad Ben Ahmed Habasi versus Denmark, in which the applicant, a national of Tunisia with official resident status in Denmark, was refused a loan by a Danish bank on the sole ground of his non-Danish nationality, clearly found a violation of the applicant's rights and freedoms under convention. Now let me turn to the crucial question, which is, is it anti-Semitic to call "do not buy from the Israeli"? In 2003, Andrew Wilkie, and I think that this case is familiar to many of you, professor of pathology at Oxford University, had refused an Israeli student's employment in his laboratory. In his email to the student, Professor Wilkie wrote, I quote, "Thank you for contacting me, but I don't think this would work. I have a huge problem with the way that the Israelis take the moral high ground from the appalling treatment in the Holocaust and then inflict gross human rights abuses on the Palestinians because the Palestinians wish to live in their own country. I'm sure that you are perfectly nice at a personal level, but no way would I take on somebody who had served in the Israeli army. As you may be aware, I'm not the only UK scientist with these views, but I'm sure you will find another suitable lab if you look around." Is Professor Wilkie, who committed an obvious act of discrimination based on nationality, an anti-Semite? I do not know. This could be determined by a court inquiring into this particular case. However, the very language used in this letter, the group-based responsibility mentioned, and the reference to often anti-Semitic motif about Jews abusing the Holocaust argument prove that Professor Wilkie participated in the kind of social exclusion that anti-Semites have always practiced against Jews. Any attempt at isolation and exclusion beyond the circle of mutual contacts and interpersonal relations promotes an atmosphere of suspicion, fear, contempt, and in consequence, verbal or physical aggression against the group concerned. Such actions are not only discriminatory, but also violate one of the most fundamental human rights, the right to dignity. In the pre-war Germany, but also Poland, signs "do not buy from a Jew" were not merely a protest against the alleged economic domination of Jews in the commerce, but also an exclusion of Jews from the society and the refusal of their right to equal participation in the life of the nation and in the state. Now, what is Israel's legislative response to that? The anti-boycott bill passed into law in July 2011 allows citizens to bring civil suits against persons and organizations that call for economic, cultural, or academic boycotts against Israel, Israeli institutions, or regions under Israel control. The second part of the law says that the person or an institution that declare a boycott of Israel or the settlements will not be able to receive governmental tenders. The most controversial aspect of this law concerns the lack of legal definitions of actions and expressions which constitute a boycott. Although it does not impose any criminal law sanctions, this provision is clearly too general and thus contrary to the international human rights law standards. As a result, two fundamental freedoms, freedom of speech and freedom of association, are likely to be infringed. Undoubtedly, if an individual whose rights have been violated by the anti-boycott law lodged a complaint to the International Human Rights Court, such as the UN Human Rights Committee, Israel will be found guilty of such a violation. At the same time, one must notice the fierce accusations against Israel, which emerged after the adoption of this law, were lacking both in proportion and merits. Intense and turbulent public debate and discussion about the new law in Israel and the court notions challenging the law, which were initiated by many opponents, prove more than anything else that Israel is a democratic state. I would like to refer here briefly to an example of a controversial Polish provision of criminal law. In 2006, the Polish parliament, with the votes of the Right Nationalist Coalition then in power, incorporated into the criminal code a new provision which instituted a crime of the so-called defamation of the Polish nation by blaming it for involvement in Nazi and communist crimes. To a large extent, this regulation was a legal response to the truth described by Jan Tomasz Gross in his books published around that time. And it was the truth about blackmail, extortion, denunciation, betrayal, and plunder of the living and the dead committed by part of Polish society against the Jews in many places in Poland during the Second World War and directly after its end. This provision was a clear violation of all possible standards of free speech and academic freedom, enforcing historical lies with the authority of law. But does it mean that by adopting this law, Poland turned from democracy into a kind of totalitarian regime? No one would ever advance such opinion. In case of Israeli anti-boycott law, such accusations appeared on the regular basis. The best solution that can and should be applied by Israel, just as by any other individual victim of an anti-Israeli boycott, is to persistently refer to international human rights law by making individual complaints to treaty bodies or, when applicable, to European Court of Human Rights, and by raising this issue of violation of human rights at international forum. Some concluding remarks. Both the universal and the European system of human rights protections are founded on a few fundamental principles, which are absolute, and from which there are no exceptions. Those principles, which are binding first of all upon authorities, but also upon individuals, have become part and parcel of national systems of all democratic states. One of them is a prohibition of discrimination based on nationality, race, or ethnic origin, and a ban upon incitement to hatred and advocacy of violence against individuals or groups based on their racial, ethnic, or national characteristics. Clearly, an exclusion of an Israeli scholar from a research team based purely on his or her nationality is an act of discrimination prohibited by international law of human rights. Does it also constitute promotion of anti-Semitic hatred against him or her? Legal evaluation of any specific instance is a matter of national or international court to determine. Various individual choices and decisions which we make when we decide to boycott products coming from a particular country or in our interpersonal relations are, and rightly so, outside the scope of legal rules. When, however, they are made beyond the purely private sphere of separate individuals, the state must interfere in order to prevent acts of discrimination. After all, as the European Court of Justice ruled, not even a private employer is allowed to announce that candidates of Moroccan background need not apply. Neither may a university professor refuse supervision to a student on the basis that this student holds an Israeli passport. There are no exceptions to these rules. Thank you.